531.
Now for our weekly wrap-up of global politics with Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Good afternoon, Dr. Stephen. And this afternoon, we begin with Afghanistan. The situation is worsening, but the top US general is still holding out hope. Tell us more.
Good afternoon, Brian. Yes, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, America's number one soldier, has expressed a bit of optimism that the Taliban, yes, may have captured something like half of the territory, but not half of the people. He emphasizes that none of the 34 provincial capitals has been taken by the Taliban. This is where the majority of Afghans live. The more they get compressed, the better able the Afghan military forces are able to defend them. The United States has not deserted Afghanistan with regard to air support. In fact, they have made some air strikes just in the last couple of days against the Taliban. They're going to support the salaries of the armed forces of Afghanistan, the salaries of the contractors that keep the Afghan Air Force flying, and in other respects, support the government in Kabul. So General Milley expresses some optimism. He said it's not over yet. Don't be so pessimistic. Yes, there is strategic momentum in favor of the Taliban, but it will slow, and there may be then a stalemate. So, Brian, I will keep your listeners up to date week by week as the situation unfolds. Brian?
The situation now between the US and China doesn't seem to be improving. What happened during a high-level meeting on Monday, Dr. Stephen?
Well, you're quite right, Brian. The Deputy Secretary of State met the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs of China in Tianjin, China. The last meeting took place in Alaska, so I guess they're going to alternate U.S. soil or Chinese soil. And Wendy Sherman was going there to put a number of proposals to the Chinese for working together where they can in some areas. But when she got there, she was given a list of grievances by the Chinese. The Chinese accused the United States of changing the rules, of a highly misguided mindset and dangerous policy, and indicated that China had some basic interests that the United States was not reflecting. So there was a certain confrontational element, and it certainly illustrated to those of us that we don't have a transcript of the meeting. It was behind closed doors. But what was said later on by the Chinese and American side indicate it was confrontational. That is, the common ground was not found. The strategic competition between the two giant governments continues, and the relations are at a low ebb. Where do we go from here? Well, there will be subsequent meetings on specialized areas, and we can only hope that the confrontation will not spiral out of control into conflict. I don't think it will be resolved. There are irresolvable conflicts about trade policy, for example, human rights policy, about China's encroachment in the South China Sea. And China, of course, has its grievances with the United States. So I think managing the conflict is all we can hope for at the present. Our expectations must be modest. But again, I'll keep you up to date, at you and your listeners, Brian.
Geography question now, Dr. Stephen. Mali, where is Mali, and what's been happening there lately?
Mali is a country we don't hear much about, but it is one of the larger countries in Africa. It's also one of the poorest, and it's one that stretches from north to south. And it's in technically in West Africa, but its northern part actually has Berber, Arab-speaking, and Tuareg people in it. That is, it borders on the Sahara Desert and on Algeria. In the south, where 90% of the population live, they speak a different language, Bambara, and there is therefore a severe split. Now, this wouldn't normally be newsworthy, the fact that there is a difference, that the north wants to secede from the south wants to keep the country together, but also the military have taken over now for the fifth time, two times in the past year, and that Mali has been condemned by the African Union, the economic community of West African states, and other critics, and the French, who are the former colonial power and have sent troops to Mali to keep the situation under control, have pulled out, and now they're going back in again. And why is that? And this is why Mali is important. It's because Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have found a lodgment in northern Mali. So it's not just a matter of internal politics and disputes. It's also a question of international terrorists who are finding refuge in northern Mali, and that the French and other African countries are very concerned to contain this growth of terrorist cells and organizations, because they will spread to neighboring countries, and they could become an international menace that could again threaten European countries and North American countries. So we're going to keep our eye on Mali and hope that the new government, whether it's civilian or military, with their French allies and their other African allies, can maintain some sort of order and curb the growth of terrorism in northern Mali. Brian?
Now, an important anniversary yesterday for one of our top trade partners, Dr. Stephen. Tell us more.
Yes, yesterday was the anniversary, the 68th anniversary of the signing of the armistice between North and South Korea. In 1950, North Korea, which supported by the Soviet Union and by China, attacked South Korea. The United States came to South Korea's aid, rallied the United Nations, including New Zealand, and fought back, and eventually the two sides reached a military demarcation line along the 38th parallel, somewhat irregular line, not a straight line, but it is a clear demarcation, which is demilitarized, 2 kilometers on either side. Now, the reason this is important is because the South has become a democracy. It's become a free market economy. It's become one of the 10th largest industrial countries in the world. We all drive Korean products, the Kia automobile, for example. We use Samsung electronics. We eat Lotte foods and confectionaries. And South Korea has become a good partner, the 5th best trade partner for New Zealand in certain years, sometimes displacing the United Kingdom as our 5th best trade partner. So we want to continue to support. And so I wrote an article, it was in the Herald yesterday, saying that we should remember this forgotten war because it's not over yet. There was an armistice, but an armistice simply means ceasefire. So the guns have gone still, but there are various threats from the North against the South that continue. The North continues to develop nuclear weapons and missiles, and we have to be vigilant. The United States has 30,000 troops stationed in South Korea, and New Zealand sends a small contingent of New Zealand Defense Force troops or observers to monitor the ceasefire and to generally report on the situation at the demilitarized zone. So my plea was simply remember the forgotten war, remember that it's still going on, remember that South Korea still needs support. It is a worthy partner. It is firmly in the democratic and Western camp, and it's a good friend to New Zealand, and we want this to continue. Brian?
Now, turning to our Pacifica region, bad then good news. Let's begin with Fiji. Recent detentions in Fiji significant, not only locally, but also internationally.
Yes, we read what I can see from the news reports, Brian, and correct me if I'm wrong, those of you closer to the Fiji situation, but it looks as if the government of Fiji has arrested a number of people for political protest. That is, not for subversion, not for violence, not for crime, but because they disagree with the Itake Land Trust Act that is going before Parliament. Now, the Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, wants to change the land law, in some respects commendably, to equalize opportunities, and I think this would benefit the Indo-Fijians. But the Itake, the indigenous Fijians, are up in arms. It's going to reduce some of their privileges, their traditional privileges, in what they regard as their own country. That is, the Indians are more recent immigrants. So there is this Indian-Fijian division behind this this protest. Well, the Itaque, they're saying they want to go to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of People and appeal to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And that's why it becomes an international issue. It may set a precedent of an indigenous group making a successful appeal to the United Nations bodies. It will certainly have implications for Maori, for Aborigines, for Inuit in Canada, and other first world people, fourth world people, indigenous people. So we're going to watch this with some interest. So it's not only local. We don't want the government to create political prisoners and to arrest people, as they sometimes do in Nauru, for just political protest or objection. But we also want to see that indigenous rights are given their day in court and given the proper respect. Over to you, Brian.
And finally, of course, Samoan politics, stability on the political front in Samoa. Your outtake as a global political analyst, Dr. Stephen.
Brian, you're the expert on Samoa, you and your colleagues. All I will say, looking at it from an outsider, is well done, Samoa. You did it without violence, without arresting anybody. You did it through the courts. You did it legally. And at the end of the day, the previous prime minister has agreed he will work with the current government. He has conceded with dignity and grace, although after quite a vigorous fight, I should say. But he now has accepted the court's, the High Court's decision, and Fiji will go forward under the prime ministership of Prime Minister Fiame Mataafa. Now, this is significant for two reasons. Number one, it's an inspiration because she's one of the first female Pacific leaders, so other females in other countries may come forward, put themselves into the political arena, and take leadership positions. But also, from the point of view of relations with China, that is, China has offered a very attractive $140 million port development project for Samoa. But Fiame has said, look, we really don't need that, and we don't want to get into further debt with China. So she may be saying no to China, and this might be the high point of China's Belt and Road Initiative, because it's not only Samoa, but many other governments are expressing a little bit of doubt about the way the Chinese are conducting these projects with Chinese workers, Chinese finance, Chinese materials, Chinese design, all to benefit Chinese exporters, maybe the Chinese military in some cases. So she may, in fact, be a trendsetter, and other governments may be moving in the same direction, and we might find that the door to China that hitherto has been quite open by many countries around the world, it may be slowly closing, and China may find itself facing headwinds in its attempt to win friends and influence people through its loans and its Belt and Road projects. Over to you, Brian.
And Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts, for another week of global political wrap-up. Thank you, as always, Dr. Stephen. We'll look forward to your company again, same time next Wednesday. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thank you, Brian.